Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is January 1st, 2015, and hopefully you made it through 2014. You're all still listening out there. I should sell a t-shirt, I survived 2014, because what a crazy, crazy year. The year that they were planning on crashing the dollar, but because Putin pulled out of the dollar world and started selling oil in off of the dollar, the world bankers had to reverse what they were going to do as far as crashing the dollar and actually bolstered the dollar. So now the dollar is very strong against all foreign currencies, making it impossible for Putin to sell his oil to any other country and driving down the economy of Russia. That's the whole point. But the other issue is that, like many secondary economies, those people don't depend on for example, in many third world countries, there's two economies going on. There's the economy of the poor, and there's the economy of the wealthy. And they don't cross. The poor people don't buy anything, literally. They don't buy anything from the rich. And the rich don't cross into that economy of the poor other than hiring them for slave labor, basically, at completely ridiculous low costs to move cement or whatever they do. But the point here is that those economies do not cross. They're like parallel universes economically. And when Putin did that, now they're talking about the economy of Russia falling, but that's relative to the Western world. Understand that Europe is not doing very well in all of this either, because they traded heavily with Russia for things like oil, natural gas. They depended on those, and now they're not going to get them. So this is not a swell situation for the so-called West, the free world. So the sanctions, etc., are backfiring. The the increase of the dollar... At any rate, I'm not going to concentrate too much on the economy other than you have to take care of yourselves. You have to economically take care of yourselves. How can you benefit from this change in the value of the dollar? In some third world countries, it's changed as much as 40%. At any rate, just plan on taking care of yourselves, because part of this is that fluctuation will change at some point in the future. That could reverse. But at any rate, at this time, prices are down, and it's actually could help local economies. So work in your own local economy. Buy food from local producers who produce organic, non-GMO food. Find outlets like that, etc. So, anyway, that's just a short note. I'll be talking a little bit about predictions for the year coming up. I've done an analysis for this year, 2015, regarding planetary electrical conditions and hurricanes, something I predict every year. And once again, 2015 is a year in which there is really nothing that would happen. Now, these predictions, I've been right about these every year, and of course I know the conditions that cause and can spawn serious hurricane activity. The sun remains at a relatively low ebb, and so it's kind of out of whack. We have a lot more higher energy radiation coming from the sun, but the energy which heats the earth, the visible light, is lower than normal. Also, the electrical conditions seem to be somewhat expended, and so we don't have the high level of electrical conditions. The solar capacitor is indicating that it's lower, has a lower energy state than normal, so the discharge of that capacitor is lower than normal. So even if we have solar flare conditions, it's the propensity to create hurricanes is less. Given the fact that we don't have any major electrical multiple planetary alignments coming up in 2015, it's fairly easy to predict that it won't be a major year for hurricanes, it's even going to be difficult if the idiots controlling the laser satellites want to create hurricanes. It's going to be even relatively difficult for them to do that. But that doesn't mean it won't happen. I just want to review 2014. I did a lot of investigation on chemtrail spraying. Now, the type of investigation I did was relating airplanes that are doing the chemtrail spraying to, number one, are they commercial jets? And the answer is no. They are not commercial jets. So we have airplanes, jets, commercials looking, they look just like commercial jets, but they're flying the crossing patterns. This is in Florida. You see it up on the Canadian border. They will actually fly along the Canadian border, lay down the chemtrails early in the morning, and then these follow the airstream patterns, the upper layer airstream patterns, and fill the sky, thusly blocking, in some cases, up to 50% of the sunlight entering. And that was what was causing the cold weather all summer, the cold weather that went into the fall, the early cold winter. And just due to my own ability to spend time on this, I haven't been able to keep up with it later in the winter of 2014. But very definitely controlling climate by chemtrail spraying on a daily basis. These are not commercial jets. They're independent. I even found one pilot who thought he was funny doing a barrel roll with a chemtrail jet. And these are, like I say, they're just like commercial jets, two and four engine. A lot of these are big planes, four engine jet planes. So at any rate, those are a couple quick reviews of 2014. And the prediction for 2015 regarding hurricanes is something I do every year. Really not a lot on the table. I've talked about science and mathematics in the past year. The fact that there is simply ongoing misinformation now coming out of the mathematics world regarding prime numbers. I put a big posting on my webpage regarding that. And it's a very complex issue. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this program. I put a posting on my webpage. Go see that, jmccsci.com. But also the issue of science, the Rosetta results continue to be clouded. They are now orbiting a comet. 67P is the abbreviation. That comet is, they have an orbiter and a lander that is actually on the surface of the comet. They're not releasing, as of yet, they're not releasing photographs, they're not releasing data, hardcore data, but I've had personal communications with the staff on the Rosetta mission, and clearly, it's not doing what the comets are not doing what the dirty snowball model predicts. In fact, I'll read a note here. This is on Science News, which is a kind of a science for the general public review of scientific issues. They had the top 25 scientific stories of 2014. Two of the top 25 had to do with the Rosetta mission at a comet. And here's, I'll read this exact quote. This is from the head of the scientific mission there in the European Space Agency. It says, and I quote, I'm reading from the article, this is the main point that they're trying to make. The images, I'm reading from the article now in Science News, it says, the images quickly revealed that 67P violates the conventional wisdom of comets resembling smooth, dirty snowballs. And then if you read in the other article, the second article in Science News of the top 25 stories of 2014, it says simply that comets are not dirty snowballs, that the traditional wisdom of comets being dirty snowballs, it's just not there. What they've got is a hot, dry rock, and they're befuddled. They don't know what to do because all of the press, all the publicity has been expectation, their lander, all of the scientific packages on board, the orbiter and the lander, all of these tailored to a dirty snowball. When they drilled into the nucleus, they have a drill bit, which is, you know, obviously hard steel, can drill through anything. They hit a surface that they could not drill into, which would tell me that this is some seriously hard metal in the nucleus of this comet. And they said, oh, that must be water. And I'm thinking, you know, ice is not, you know, ice or snow, which they say it's supposed to be, is not exactly something that's going to resist a hardened steel drill bit. That would be, what do you think, they're putting a soft clay drill bit on this orbiter? No, or this lander? No, it's super hard steel that can drill through anything, but they got to something they couldn't drill into, and that's where the drill stopped, about 20 centimeters into the nucleus. And they said, oh, that must be the water. I mean, these people are just in la-la land. That's the only thing you can say about it. So anyway, 2014, clearly proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that comets are not dirty snowballs. It even forces them to say that, but then they keep coming back to this, oh, well, the water must be deeper inside. The point is, and the point has always been, of the, what, now six comets that have been visited by man-made satellites, the point is that there's never been any water or snow or ice discovered on any of these. And additionally, the bigger point is nothing is coming off the nucleus. I wrote to the European Space Agency and got a reply from the head scientist there that the water they were measuring, remember the deuterium water I talked about in last week's show, the heavy water, was discovered 10 kilometers above the nucleus. So literally nothing is coming off the nucleus. They have seen some jetting and some other activity coming off the nucleus, but in no way, shape, or form can that explain the continual flow that would have to be there to create the tail, which is visible from a distance. And like I say, 10 kilometers, 100 kilometers above, the orbiter can detect with its spectrometer the various elements, organics, etc. But they don't know what to do because on the nucleus itself, they're not detecting any of this. No organic molecules, no water, no water vapor, no ice. And they're just kind of speculating because a drill bit hit something hard. They say, oh, that must be the water. Complete fairy tale science. And this is being pawned off on the public. Clearly in the background, in those offices over there in the European Space Agency, they're obviously talking about the fact that this is not a dirty snowball and how to get around that. And of course, I'm announcing this on the air every week. They're listening to me announcing to you that they're wrong, and I've been doing this for years and decades. And so they're trying to figure out how to release something new, but they have to stick with this dirty snowball story, because if they don't, NASA and NASA funding for other projects will go by the wayside. Okay, some other issues going on here. Something that's very much not being announced in the general news media, the Bárðarbunga volcano in Iceland is erupting on a daily basis. The tremors there are at the point where they're predicting any day for this thing to blow up could affect all of Europe. Previously, there were volcanic eruptions there that affected a lot of the flights going into England, if you remember in the past year or two. But this volcano, if it goes, could threaten all of Europe, and they're not talking about this. So just you can look up and see the activity regarding this. It's the Bárðarbunga, just like it sounds, Bárðarbunga volcano in Iceland. And you can follow that online. But of something that could blow up in 2015, and if it did, wow, it could stop all air traffic. It could layer Europe and all of Northern Europe with in England, Ireland, the British Isles, etc., with a layer of volcanic ash could threaten crops, agriculture. Of course, any type of industry would be affected, something that definitely will be keeping a watch on here. It's come to my attention that in some radio programs, people have been using my name and then making claims that they have pictures of Planet X. And I just want to say publicly on my own show, I have nothing to do with this. It's really incorrect to use my name-dropping, and talking about Planet X so-called pictures. And let me explain what you need scientifically to make some kind of claim about Planet X or a comet or anything else, for that matter. You need multiple pictures. You need not only pictures that, like, oh, this is, because a picture doesn't tell you anything. If somebody took a picture of a robin on a snowbank and said, this is a robin at the South Pole, that's the equivalent of a picture somebody's taking and say, oh, this is Planet X. It's not verifiable. And so what people need is a scientific explanation. That means orbital data. That means third-party verifiable data so that anybody can go and look at whatever they're looking at and verify that, number one, it's not a known object. Second, that it's, it has to be verifiable. That's not being done. So simply posting a picture of something that they claim is up in the sky, like I say, it's like taking a picture on a snowbank of a robin and saying this is a robin at the South Pole. It's just not verifiable. There's just getting back to the issue of the Rosetta mission. They made an announcement that came out about mid-December that ice is hiding under the surface of the comet, and they know this, they claim, because the surface is a color of gray, and for some reason that would indicate that there's water underneath. Now, how they come to this magical conclusion, I have no idea. But the issue here is that if there's ice there or there's snow, it has to be coming off the nucleus in all directions equally to form this beautiful tail that's constantly there. And so not seeing that, you know, it's a moot point if there's water under the surface or not, because it's not coming off the nucleus to form the tail. And so you see the level of bad science that's being pawned off on the public. Ferguson, Missouri, of course, this year I got a series of pictures, and it's basically mob rule. The pictures show looting every major convenience store and the big stores, the big box stores in the Walmarts, etc., and they had a whole laundry list of the stores that had been looted. The only stores that were not looted were the ones that the local people literally went down with guns in their hands, stood in front of their stores, and the looters were running by, but the police stood by and did nothing. So the situation, a mob rule, and this is the police state, most foreign countries, the ones that the U.S. criticizes the most, for example, Venezuela and other countries, are criticizing the United States for becoming a police state. If you hear some noise in the background, there's some activity going on over which I don't have any control, unfortunately. And so this happens to be a situation I'm in for this New Year's program. But hopefully ignore that. But Ferguson, Missouri, now this is something you have to understand. All the people involved, John Moore lives right next there. I talked to him about this. The situation is that, yesterday morning, I think John did a special program on the situation with police in this country. There's an increasing number of basically open-air shootings of policemen, and so we have a country in which police have been given high levels of power. They've been brought into the security agencies, the federal security agencies, but it's a very tenuous situation between the police and the public now. And so basically, I think we're going to see a lot more of this. One of the main points is that in Ferguson, Missouri, professionals have been brought in from outside that area to cause trouble. And so they're instigating problems based on these events, like the shooting of a unarmed black man. The people that are in charge are using this. The people who control the world in the United States and are looking for chaos, basically, are using these incidents to instigate chaos. And they live because there is chaos in the world. Just a quick note here, there is a comet right now, and this is on the brighter side. That's a new comet discovered by Terry Lovejoy. Now, Terry Lovejoy is the amateur astronomer who discovered Comet Lovejoy of 2012. This was the famous sun-diving comet that there was so much controversy. There was all kinds of issues going on with that. And I reported heavily on that. But this is a new comet discovered this past August. The designation is, excuse me, Comet C2014Q2. And it has no, I looked at the orbit, it does not have any electrical interactions with any of the planets. It's coming in from almost perpendicular to the plane of the planets. When it crosses the plane of the planets, it has no interaction. And but anyway, on my webpage, I have a little announcement, and it's got a finder chart, which allows you to look at the location of the comet on a nightly basis. It's crossing right below the constellation Orion, which is one of our wintertime constellations, very bright in the night sky. So it's very easy to find this comet, and it's naked eye visible, which means you can see it without any equipment of any kind. It would be helpful to have a pair of binoculars. Binoculars are the best equipment with a tripod. The binoculars would be the best type of equipment to view comets. Small telescopes are not typically very good for comets. They look like a little fuzzy dot. A good pair of binoculars and my own comet viewing equipment, I have an 8-inch Meade telescope, which is a very nice telescope. With tracking and electrical mount and everything and optics and camera, digital camera equipment. That's the telescope that I use because it is portable. You can actually transport this telescope to any place. You can carry it on an airplane and it arrives in one piece, etc. So that's the telescope of choice that I have. But that's a nice telescope. But when I really want to look at a comet, I have binoculars. I have a number of sets of binoculars, and the main binoculars I use for comet viewing are very large. They're astronomical specific binoculars, and so many people just don't have access to this. But you can actually buy some of these if you're interested in looking at stars and comets, especially comets. For a few hundred dollars, you can buy a very nice set of binoculars, go to one of the online stores, or if you're fortunate enough to have a telescope vendor in your area, I would support my local businesses, of course. But these are the optics, the lenses and prisms, etc., in an astronomical-grade apparatus, whether it's a telescope or binoculars. They're what you call coated lenses. They put a fine coating on the ground lenses that gives them a perfectly flat surface, and it makes the images much brighter and sharper. So at any rate, up in the night sky right now, January 1st, and then for the next week, actually it will become brighter, according to predictions. This comet will become brighter in the night sky as we progress through to about the 6th. It's supposed to peak in brightness about the 6th of January and then start getting progressively dimmer. So you have a rich viewing session coming up here with this comet. And as I said, go to my webpage right at the near the top. There will be a write-up about this comet, and then you can there's a clickable chart you can click on. It's a PDF file. You could print it off and then take it out in the night sky to locate this comet. So, and like I say, this is not a dangerous comet. It's not close to Earth. It's just it's not close to any other planet. There's the one thing you can say about it, however, is that it's a blue. The ion tail is blue, and the coma, that's the gas cloud around the comet nucleus, is green. And, of course, the standard mouthpieces, spaceweather.com for NASA, though these standard mouthpieces are trying to pretend that this green color is normal, and it's just the glowing color of gases in the air. What a stupid thing to say. Clearly, these are electrical. It's like a neon light bulb in the sky being lit up by the electrical current that's passing through the region of the comet nucleus. And that's due to, explained in my plasma discharge comet model. Once again, comets exhibiting properties that should never be there in a dirty snowball model. But at any rate, like I say, Comet Lovejoy, Comet C, 2014 Q2, up in the night sky, visible with the naked eye. So go out anytime after dark. Look for the Orion constellation Orion, and down below its feet, you will find the comet. And take that finder chart along with you. It's easy to find. Something fun to do, and relative to comets, looking up in the night sky and understanding that you can actually see the green color being caused by the electrical discharge that's passing through the comet region. Okay, a listener wrote in and asked, where is the information that the ancients saw the Mars, the atmosphere of Mars, and the oceans being taken off by the comet Venus? And this is in Velikovsky. Unfortunately, I don't have my Velikovsky books with me right now because they are physical books. And I just don't have them with me right now, so I couldn't find the specific reference, but that's easy to find. I don't know where that is, where Velikovsky talks about the Mars losing its oceans, but the ancients saw this, and he has many references to ancient cultures saying the same thing. As the large comet Venus came through the solar system, it interacted with Mars. And let me first of all explain this, what it looked like in the night sky. Now, we all know what Mars looks like. According to the legends, Mars came much closer to Earth in those days. So the orbits of Earth and Mars changed when Venus came through the solar system. And so, basically, though, Mars was a blue planet. This tells you something that the ancients knew, that a blue planet meant a water planet, and there's indications that there was travel between Mars and Earth back in those days. In other words, they were a spacefaring society, something that NASA talks about doing, but it's always 20 years down the line. They never do it, probably never will do it, but they can't even get into low Earth orbit right now. So they're building a spacecraft, looks like an Apollo-style spacecraft, but that's all smoke and mirrors. That's not the real space program that goes on in the background, unbeknownst to the general public. But back to Mars, this implies that the ancient public knew about a blue planet, and that Mars was a blue planet. That meant it was a water planet, that it would harbor life, etc. And then when Venus the comet came by, it removed the atmosphere from Mars, and they saw this at a distance. So let me explain what it looked like to them. Now remember, the comet would have looked extremely large in the night sky, and the planet was just basically almost like a little dot in the night sky. But the color blue. Now when the comet came in that region of space, all of a sudden you see a tentacle-like snake protrusion coming out of the comet and attaching to Mars. And when this happened, now the auroras up in the upper atmosphere of Mars would have illuminated, and so this basically would look like, take your arm, extend it out, and put your hand like you were had your thumb around one side of a baseball or a tennis ball, and all your four fingers were around the other side of the tennis ball. So you have the tennis ball in your hand with your thumb wrapped around one side, your other four fingers wrapped around the other, and what you see is kind of like a snake's mouth with the tennis ball in the middle. And that's what it looked like, with the extended, kind of like a snake whipping around with that planet in its mouth. And all of a sudden, they start to see the planet change colors. They see that blue water streaming out up the snake-like protrusion and off into outer space, leaving the blue planet as the red planet we see today. Now, these people were intelligent enough to understand that the comet took the oceans off of Mars, and obviously the atmosphere that holds the ocean in place along with it, so leaving Mars as the dead, dry planet that we see today. And of course, the Mars rovers and all of the NASA activity there, whenever they discover something, one of their so-called main objectives is to find out what happened to the water on Mars. Obviously, there was water. There's oceans, there's erosion, there's riverbeds, there's all the signs of water being on Mars, but there ain't no water. But the NASA story is, oh, this happened millions and billions of years ago, and they don't know why. Well, we all know why, because the comet Venus passing by took and drew off the water. Now, how does this happen? It happens because the nucleus of the comet Venus was more massive than the mass, the surface gravity of Mars. So once that electrical connection occurred, the nucleus of the comet won the tug of war over the water that was on Mars. When the same comet came by Earth, the nucleus of the comet was less massive. The surface gravity of the nucleus was less than that of Earth. So Earth won the tug of war, and we had a tremendous pollution event, which is described in the Bible and all the old texts. So at any rate, now I've talked about this many times on this show. I talk about it in my books, etc. And it's is explained by my plasma discharge comet model that some comets are large. They're planetary in size. Now this is very unusual. The majority of comets are small. But for scientists and astronomers to say that all comets have to be small is ridiculous. It's the most ridiculous thing under the sun. If you look at the distribution, the statistical distribution of objects in outer space, very few are big. But they all have one thing in common, a characteristic, that when they're in the solar system, they all discharge the solar capacitor. Earth is doing it, Jupiter is doing it, all the planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, all of the planets are doing this. When the comet sighting spring came by Mars this past fall, Mars gained a tremendous amount of atmosphere, including heavy metals were found in the atmosphere of Mars. All of this happening, and certainly not being caused by a dirty snowball, for which they expected literally nothing to happen, Mars gained a tremendous amount of atmosphere. And so that was from a comet, a small comet, a very little comet, passing within approximately 80,000 miles of the planet Mars. And so you can see that in that case, Mars being bigger than the comet nucleus by a tremendous amount, Mars won the tug of war for the atmospheric properties of the comet and had a tremendous, what you'd call a pollution event. It drew in the materials from the comet coma, that's the gaseous part around the nucleus of the comet, and Mars gained that atmosphere. So, and it was measurable, actually being announced by NASA, but of course they have no way of understanding how a little snowball could add atmosphere to Mars. It wouldn't make any sense. So once again, a listener question asking where the reference is to Venus, the comet taking off the atmosphere of Mars. And like I say, I don't have my Velikovsky books with me right now, so I couldn't look up and get you a page number or a chapter number. But it is there, I guarantee you. And also, just a note, there's a lot of there are many sites on the internet that try and use Velikovsky's name as a draw. And so if you want to know what Velikovsky said, read the Velikovsky books. It's as simple as that. Okay, on my webpage, I posted about a week ago, there's a CO2 map that NASA puts out regularly. This was sent in by a listener to comment on this. So this map measures the worldwide CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, this is a satellite that looks down on the Earth, maps this continually, the CO2 concentration, and they give the data for the period of October 1st to November 11th. I have this map on my webpage. And what you see is that the CO2 in the atmosphere, oddly enough, the densest concentration of CO2 is not above New York City. It's not above Los Angeles. It's not above Cleveland or other places where there's a lot of, say, coal burning to create electricity for the metal industries. It's not above industrial cities in China, which we know are some of the most polluting regions on the planet. It's above the Amazon jungle, where there's the absolute least amount of human activity on the entire planet, the Amazon jungle. So are we to believe that the aboriginal natives in the Amazon jungle are creating CO2? What exactly are those people doing down there to create all that CO2? Well, it's absolutely ridiculous, of course. The end result is that you can see, like in the Sumatra area where there's some active volcanoes, you can see the CO2 production. You can see other areas on the map of CO2 production based on volcanic activity. But over the oceans, you know, there's a couple spots in the ocean where there's some CO2 activity, probably caused by underwater volcanic activity. But what the map conclusively proves is that there is absolutely no contribution to the CO2 from any man-made source. This is time averaged over more than a month of time, from October. October is 31 days to September 11th, so that's 42 days of data. Not a single drop of the CO2 emissions are coming from industrial sources. Is that bizarre? So it completely proves that man-made CO2 is a myth. The if you take the extension of that, even if there were CO2, if you try and match that to global warming, the CO2 does not correspond with global warming. The global warming is out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in the surface heating of the Pacific Ocean, places like that. The CO2 is not commensurate with higher temperatures either. So literally, if you look at the links in a chain, there is no chain. The CO2 is not man-made. The CO2, even if it were there, is not creating higher temperatures. And this leads on to another point, and I had a little interchange with a listener on this, because I made a mention on a previous show, that the idea that plants convert CO2 to oxygen and provide us with oxygen, that is a myth also. And the fact is that one time, a long, long time ago, I was sitting in an airport up in a northern state, and it was in the middle of winter, and I'm looking out over the landscape, And of course, if there's snow on the ground, all the trees, it looks like the moon. There's no leaves on the tree. There's nothing green. It's either looks dead. And I found it interesting that people come from foreign countries, especially if they grew up in the tropics and they come to a northern state or northern climate and where there's snow and it's winter, and they look and they go, it looks like everything's dead. You go, yeah, but then it all grows back in the spring, and they don't understand that. They never have seen where everything is literally dead. But the point is that in the northern climates, first of all, the movement of air around the world is in an easterly direction, whether it's at the southern hemisphere or the northern hemisphere. The movement of air, etc., is easterly. It doesn't mix north and south very much at all. And so in the northern climates during winter, there's no production of oxygen because everything's dead. There's mainly land. When you go around the world, there's a little bit of ocean between the United States and Northern Europe. But if you look, the majority of land in the world is in the Northern Hemisphere. If you look at the globe from the south, pick up a globe sometime, go down to a place that's kind of in the South Indian Ocean, somewhat down near Antarctica, and hold the globe, you'll find that it's all water. That's because the Earth is egg-shaped, and most of the land, which is the water, is on the one side of the globe. Most of the land is on the other, and most of that land is in the Northern Hemisphere. There's very little land in the Southern Hemisphere. And so the point is that the oceans are not contributing. This is another false theory that has come out of NASA, that somehow the oceans now are contributing the CO2 oxygen conversion. It's strictly false, because there's really no difference in oxygen level in the northern winter climates than there is in the tropics. In fact, the CO2 map of NASA shows that the CO2 concentration is higher in the tropical regions and highest of all over the Amazon jungle, where supposedly the jungle is supposed to be converting that CO2 into oxygen and supplying our entire world with oxygen. So it's a complete myth. Every link of the chain of global warming science is missing. And I made this comment, and so the listener said, well, I thought that plants converted CO2 to oxygen. Well, yes, they do. But it's a little teeny bump on the top of a mountain. Basically, the Earth has a supply of oxygen. And the conversion of oxygen that occurs in the plants, as with just about everything that NASA has ever done, has been totally, totally overestimated. That's why they've now started going to the ocean conversion of oxygen and carbon dioxide, because they, in the back room, realized that the whole idea of plants converting it is completely, the numbers aren't there. But, don't depend on NASA to come out with anything truthful. Okay, so just once again, talking about the links in the chain of the so-called global warming story. First of all, you would need man-made CO2 production. The map of CO2 production of current readings right now from NASA's satellite imaging of CO2 on planet Earth shows that CO2 is not from a man-made source. That it has absolutely nothing to do with the man-made source. Second of all, the concept that CO2 would cause global warming is a total myth, because the CO2 that does exist on Earth, which is not related to any man-made source, has nothing to do with global temperature changes. You would expect then that these pockets would be generating the most amount of heat on Earth, and that's simply not the case. The idea that plants convert CO2 to oxygen to provide us with our oxygen source on Earth is a myth. And also that there's a water shortage. The whole idea of CO2 producing global warming has been used to control water, that there's a shortage of water. If you can convert someone on Earth to believe that there's a shortage on a water planet where literally three quarters of the surface of the Earth is covered with water, and all of the inland lakes plus 20% of the Earth's water is locked up into the polar ice caps and the Greenland ice cap. About 95% of our water is fresh water is captured in those. If you can convince the public that there's a water shortage on planet Earth, you can convince them of anything. So, at any rate, so the whole concept of CO2, man-made pollution, and unfortunately, too many tree huggers, green people, I'm a person that is very much ecologically minded, but you have to base your arguments on sound science. And unfortunately, the tree huggers have based their claims on unsound science, and now it's being used against them because they're saying, oh, global warming doesn't exist. We don't have to listen to these tree huggers. We can keep polluting. The reality is that if you burned all of the oil, the tar oil that exists, for example, in the Venezuela or Orinoco Valley, you would consume all of the oxygen on Earth. You would literally consume all of the oxygen. The oxygen level is fluctuating because we get oxygen from outer space every day. We get water from outer space every day. So literally none of the science you are being taught about the atmosphere, the balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the air, none of this is true. There's another question a listener sent in. How could it be that there's oil deep in the Earth's crust, like the BP oil reserves are sometimes 18 kilometers down in the Earth? And the listener says, how can there be oil that far down if it came from a comet? And the point is very clearly that the Earth has a much different history than what you've been taught. The Earth has gained oil and levels over the millenniums, over the millions and billions of years that it's been around. And scientists dating the Earth and the solar system at 4.5 billion years is ludicrous. It has nothing. What you see on the surface of the planets today that have surfaces, like Earth, like Venus, which has a surface, or Mercury, the surfaces, or the Moon, the surfaces you see today have absolutely nothing to do with what was there a billion years ago. The Earth has gained and gained and gained matter and atmosphere over its entire history. Mars' atmosphere, we know, is increasing. They, for example, sent a probe to Mars to determine the state of Martian atmosphere, because in 10 years they were planning on sending a probe that was going to use aerobraking. That's where you inflate a big balloon. It drags through the atmosphere, slows the probe down that they want to then land on the surface. In that 10-year time frame between the initial test probe of the atmosphere of Mars and when the aerobraking package arrived on Mars, the atmosphere of Mars had doubled in size. And so their aerobraking experiment, it didn't fail, it was just miscalculated. There was twice the atmosphere on Mars that there had been a simple 10 years previously. So imagine that Mars has been gaining atmosphere ever since the Venus event, which was just a few thousand years ago. What we see atmosphere on Mars today has built up since that time, because after that comet left, there was nothing there. There was no water, nothing. So Mars is regaining its atmosphere. We can see Earth has regained its atmosphere probably many times. When some of the major mass extinctions have occurred, comets have come by, large comets, which I'm sure in some cases have literally withdrawn all of the atmosphere of Earth and the oceans, and we have rebuilt over a period of time, a long period of time, to the point we have today, oceans, etc. So the universe, the solar system, the planets, the planetary bodies are very dynamic. And so the fact that we have oil deposits deep in the Earth is simply an indication that Earth has been layering up and building up over billions of years, and the history of the Earth is locked down in the deeper portions. One thing these deep deposits of oil are very much certain, these were not created by fern forests and dinosaur bones. That's one thing for certain, and that's one of the leading points when I start my book, The Diamond Principle. One of the leading points is that the oil that is found down deep in the earth could not possibly have been from fern forests. So all of the myths, in fact, if you looked at literally almost everything that's being taught at the university level in sciences today, whether it's geology or history of the earth or evolutionary biology, on and on, just about everything that you're being taught today couldn't possibly be true. The space science, the astronomy, literally not a single thing in that entourage could possibly be true. But since that's the standard so-called knowledge of the Western world, that's going to continue for decades. Once again, since this is the end of the year, beginning of another one, I want to stress parents to understand that the Common Core mathematics that's being taught is a disaster. Find true tutors for your kids who would learn then real mathematics, because when the kids get to higher level mathematics, they will be unable to do it. They will not be able to make that bridge, because the Common Core mathematics is like fairy tale lollipop mathematics, trying to get kids who don't understand math to understand math in some kind of manner. But from teaching math at all levels throughout my history, what I've come to understand that math is not something that's impossible. Everybody can understand it. When I was at Tulane, I was tutoring the football team at Tulane University in physics. They were getting A's. The linemen, the 300-pound linemen of the Tulane football team, were getting A's because of my tutoring. Now, this is not impossible stuff. It's just that it's not presented in a manner that is palatable for all people. But I've tutored people all over the planet in different languages, etc. I've tutored little kids who couldn't understand mathematics, and what I find is they've just had bad teachers. They're missing something in the link, the chain of understanding of mathematics. Anybody can understand mathematics, including higher mathematics. It's not magic. It's not something that only a few people can understand. Some people are better than others, just like driving a car or going fishing or playing basketball. Some people are better than others. But the point is that the Common Core mathematics is a disaster in the making. So parents, find real tutors that can teach your kids real mathematics and the old style mathematics. Because if not, they will not be able to make that conversion. If they want to become doctors or dentists or scientists or chemists or engineers, Common Core mathematics ain't going to cut it. So just a little warning there. Here's something that you're going to see blasted all over the news media in the coming year. And this is just coming out in the end of 2014. We've all heard of the Big Bang, and that supposedly the universe began in a Big Bang. There is something called B-mode polarized light that had been predicted as part of the light that would be given off early in the Big Bang. And supposedly, the announcement has come out that supposedly there has been a group that has detected the B-mode polarized light. And let me just explain something, and this is a flaw in both the microwave background radiation data. When they first detected microwave background radiation, it was supposed to be completely smooth because it was time averaged out of the data or of the explosion of the Big Bang, so over time it would have become very smooth. When the COBE satellite went up and actually measured the microwave background radiation, at first it looked, on the first pass, it looked very smooth, but then they set up another satellite, and what they detected was that it was very unsmooth. There were blotches, there were patches. And so what I said was that, first of all, the prediction was wrong, and the real data showed something different. But I said that this microwave background radiation is coming from the nebular ion cloud that surrounds Earth and our solar system, that it surrounds the sun way out there. And this is actually the capacitor. We see these capacitors around other stars. You can see a nebular ring around all of the other stars. And, excuse me. So the other thing is that if you're detecting a microwave background radiation or a B-mode polarized light or whatever it is from the Big Bang that supposedly is a residue of the Big Bang, then you should see it only in one direction in space, and that is near the region in space where the alleged Big Bang happened. Now, this is something, and now imagine the Big Bang occurs, all of this stuff comes spreading out, here we are on Earth, you know, supposedly 13 billion years later. Okay, if you're detecting something that occurred right after that bang happened, then that is a residue of that, then okay, that should be occurring, you should be detecting that over at that location where the Big Bang happened. And this is not the case. They're detecting these in all directions in space, not in a single direction allegedly where the Big Bang happened. They should be able to find these B-mode polarized light or the microwave background radiation in a very specific spot in outer space, not every place. So what that proves is they're seeing the residue of something else. But you're going to see a lot of, they're already talking about Nobel Prizes, and the Nobel Prize, unfortunately, has been very skewed by monopolized science. I created a word on my webpage. It's called cloistopoly. It's the combination of two words, cloistered and monopoly. And this is the Nobel Prize, University Ivory Tower Science and Mathematics, cloistopoly. It's a combination. The cloistered means living in your own little world, not communicating with anybody outside because you don't want to be tainted by the people who are living outside your little ivory tower. That's a cloistered group, and universities are cloistered. If it's not in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, then it doesn't exist, which is one of the giant myths. Okay, I'm about out of time here. So anyway, Happy New Year. I'll be talking to you next week, looking forward to a wonderful 2015 with a lot of progress in a lot of areas. My old projects continuing and some new projects coming online. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.